Blog Talk Radio.
Have you been searching for a conservative talk radio show that covers the issues you are interested in? Well, search no more. That show is Stand for Truth Radio, and I'm your host, Susan Knowles. We'll be talking about all the issues that matter to you. Our guests are political figures, military men and women, best-selling authors, and even political conservative comedians. So join us every Monday afternoon at 2 p.m. Eastern on WNJC 1360 AM and Stand for Truth.
Radio. I'm your host, Susan Knowles. You can find all of my articles at susanknowles.com, and also you can find articles at theblaze.com and joeforamerica.com, because I'm a contributor to both of those. Just a reminder, my book, Freedom's Fight, A Call to Remember, is available at amazon.com, and I'd like to quickly thank all of those who are carrying my show. Stand for Truth Radio is now carried on WNJC 1360 AM in Philadelphia and is part of the Conservative Commandos Radio Network. Also heard on the PunditPress.com, SHRMedia.com, and FreedomInAmericaRadio.com. Tonight we have a very special guest, and it's an honor to have him on our show. We're going to be talking to Lieutenant Randy Sutton. You may have heard about him because he was recently in the news, and we'll get more into that later, but right now I want to introduce him to you. Randy's police career spanned three decades when he retired as a field lieutenant with the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. To this day, he remains recognized as one of the most highly decorated officers in department history, with numerous awards for life-saving, exemplary service, and valor. He is also one of America's best-known officers, having been featured on the popular reality show Cops, America's Most Wanted, and roles in films such as Casino, Fools Rush In, and Miss Congeniality 2, as well as appearances on television network and cable news as a commentator and a regular panelist on the television show Fired Up. Randy is also a critically acclaimed author, having written four books. They are titled True Blue, Police Stories by Those Who Have Lived Them, A Cop's Life, True Blue, To Protect and Serve, and his most recent book, The Power of Legacy. He has also written extensively on the topics of ethics, integrity, and leadership for national magazines. He's the creator of the website thepoweroflegacy.com, a website dedicated to encourage the principles of honor, integrity, compassion, and kindness, subjects which he speaks passionately about to law enforcement and civic business organizations across the country. He is also the founder and president of Celebrating Legacy, a company where memories live forever, providing their members with the ability to celebrate lives in the present, honor lives from the past, and share family history for the future. So we'd like to now welcome Randy.
Oh, thanks for having me. You probably almost ran out of breath on that intro, didn't you?
I know. I mean, if you do any more in your life, it's going to be a whole show just on that. So slow down a bit.
I think the listener must think this guy doesn't know what he wants to be when he grows up.
No, that's me. I got you over on that one. Now, you know, before we get started, what I like to do is I want to just ask you a little bit about sort of your background, like where you grew up and some of the places you worked as a police officer.
Sure. I was actually born and raised in Princeton, New Jersey, a very nice community in the center of the state, and where Princeton University is located. And that was my hometown, and I became a police officer literally right out of high school at the ripe old age of 19. I joined the Princeton Borough Police Department because for a very, very brief window of time, when they changed the age of majority from 21 to 18, you could vote and you could drink and you could become a cop. And I did two out of those three, and I'll let you figure out what those are.
Now, from what I understand, you were the youngest person to ever join the Princeton Borough Police Department. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Like I said, they closed that window after a very brief period of time because they realized, well, wait a minute, do we really want 18-year-old police officers out there carrying a gun and a badge? The funny things was you could do all those things, but you couldn't buy ammunition. You had to be 21. So when I was going into the police academy, I had to go to my mother. Hey, Mom, but buying my bullets for me. It was pretty funny.
Now, do you have members who are also police officers?
My grandfather was a deputy sheriff who was shot in the line of duty. He survived, but he was shot by a poacher of all things. And then my parents were both, my father was a special deputy and my parents were both involved in the court system. And so I grew up listening to, tales of criminals and trials and things like that. And I knew from the time I was a little kid that I was going to become a cop.
And how long did you serve as a police officer?
A total of almost 34 years. I spent 10 in Princeton, and then when I came out to Las Vegas in 1986, I served for 23 and a half years until my career was cut kind of short due to a stroke that I suffered in my police car.
Now, you also, when you were back in New Jersey, back in the day, as they say, what was that like being a police officer back in New Jersey as probably compared to what it might be today?
Well, I don't really think it's in a small town atmosphere, things don't change all that radically. I actually was just back visiting in Princeton and listening to some of the guys that all of the people that I used to work with are pretty much gone. There's one or two left, but a lot of the newer folks and I sat around and had a couple cocktails and told some stories and surprisingly, there hasn't been that much change in small communities. Policing, the policing concepts don't change that much. They just kind of morph along with with the way that society goes.
And what do you think, in your 34 years, what was the hardest part about being a police officer?
Well, I would have to say the hardest part of being a cop was years of watching really, really distasteful things. When I say, and I'm being polite when I say that, you have a front row seat to every type of bad behavior that the humans are capable of. And when you get a steady diet of death and sadness and loneliness and destruction and watching people destroy their own lives with drugs or alcohol, and destroy the lives of others with sometimes physical force, sometimes, actual death and sometimes emotional death, you know, that people are capable of doing to one another. When you get a steady diet of that, it has a propensity to affect you in mental and emotional ways and even physical ways. It takes a toll of your humanity. It takes a toll of your spirit and your soul.
You know, and I think that's a really good point. I don't think a lot of people really understand. You know, we always hear about the, you know, the criminal's point of view on different things, and how hard it is for them, and especially these days. But we really don't spend a lot of time looking at, nor do we spend time talking about, you know, what police officers have to go through, what they have to see, the things that they get involved in, you know, not knowing whether or not they're going to be coming home at the end of the day, because something that might occur. And I think, you know, it's a travesty that we don't do that. And I know that, you know, one of the things I want to talk to you about, that, you know, the image of the of police has started to change. And I wanted to ask you, when did that sort of that really negative image come to pass? Is it just recently under Obama, or has it always, did it start years ago? What's your opinion on that?
Well, it's been kind of cyclical, actually. When I first became a policeman, it was in the mid-70s. And, you know, there was a huge amount of social unrest in those days due to the end of the Vietnam War and people's disillusionment with government. And when people are disillusioned with government, who winds up bearing the brunt of it? But it's the police, because they are the first line of defense. They are those who are called when there is when there are riots, when there is activity where the public safety is at risk, and they become the targets. It's like a transference, if you will. You know, the police are the most visible forms of government. That's who you see. You see the uniform, and so in the 70s, the police bore a great deal of that brunt, and then it started changing. And then in the early 90s, when 9/11 took place, that was a huge change in the way people viewed their police as well as their military. Unfortunately, it was short-lived because there were other events like the Rodney King incident, which then again, you know, the public perception was once again moved by that. So, you know, things happen through the course of history that make things maybe a little brighter sometimes and less than the others. But I've never seen anything like what we're going through now. In my entire career, what I'm witnessing now is nothing short of devastating to the law enforcement community.
And let's get into that. I know this past week was Police Week, and, you know, I saw you a lot on Fox Friends and a lot of different places because you wrote a letter to President Obama called a Police Week Plea to President Obama. Can you talk a bit about that letter?
Yeah, that was a letter that I wrote. Let me explain what Police Week is to your listeners.
Sure.
So they have a little frame of reference. Once a year, in May, President Kennedy, back in the 60s, created National Police Week as a time to honor those who've given their lives in the line of duty. And in the early, about 20 years ago, a monument was built in Washington, D.C. It's called the Law Enforcement Officers Memorial. And In this big slab of granite that covers almost a city block is the name of every police officer who's been killed in the line of duty. During Police Week, police officers from all over the nation, in fact, all over the world, converge in Washington, D.C. for events and honoring those who have given their lives. And it's a very somber time. One of the most important assignments that I had as a police officer during my career with the Las Vegas Police was to be the assistant commander of the Honor Guard. And so I buried a lot of cops. I buried a lot of friends. And it's very somber duty. It is also one of the greatest honors that you can have is to honor your dead. So this week that takes place is like the High Holy Week for police is probably right. The best interpretation that I could say. So President Bush was a strong supporter of police, and he did something that no other president has done that I know of. Every year, he would appear, and he would never make this public, by the way. I can only say this now because he's no longer president. But he would personally set aside time, hours and hours out of the day, and he would sit with the families of every police officer killed in the line of duty that year and give those people the honor and the respect for the job that they did. I drew such an incredible amount of respect for President Bush for doing that. President Obama has been, shall we say, a little bit different. his disdain for the police has been evident from early in his presidency. And my Police Week plea to him was to change that, was to support law enforcement, was to change the way that he has approached them and the job that they do. And that letter received an incredible amount of attention. First of all, I put it on my Facebook, which went viral. It's been shared like 50,000 times. And then I was approached a couple months ago and been given the great honor of becoming the national spokesman for the American Council on Public Safety. And this organization out of Washington, D.C., is a nonprofit organization that tries to show to the public what the truth is about policing, and they have chosen me to be that voice. So,
wow, that's a real honor.
When I wrote this, oh, it's a tremendous honor. I'm so grateful to be given that opportunity. So they took that post that I wrote and showed it to the Daily Caller, which then posted it as an op-ed, and they have about 16.5 million individual views. So that created even more attention, and then Fox and Friends picked it up and asked me if I would speak about it on television, and that interview took place.
Well,
so,
I
wrote this letter to the President of the United States. I even overnighted it to him, by the way. And I know you'll be shocked at this, but I have yet to hear back from him.
I am so shocked. Perhaps when he gets back off the golf course, you'll get a letter post haste. I wanted to read a part of the letter because I think it's so important for those. And I know that you can go and get it at thedailycaller.com. But I wanted to read just a couple paragraphs. You said, "This is a time of unity, of patriotism, and of reflection. My plea for you during this year's Police Week is to ask for a reflection about the men and women who each day don the uniform and badge of the American law enforcement officer. I feel pain in my heart for feeling that it is necessary to ask this of you. As a leader of this nation, I should not hesitate in my belief that you respect, honor, empathize, and support those who protect their communities with their lives. But, Mr. President, it saddens me to say that I do not believe that you do. Your words, deeds, and actions directed over the years at individual officers and the police community as a whole have helped not to heal, but to drive a wedge between those who serve in the communities they support to protect." So, you know, I think that, you had a lot to say to him, and I hope that, you know, he actually heard what you had to say. Do you feel that he adds a lot of negativity to how people view the police today?
Yes, I do. I do believe that. I've never considered myself to be a political person. I always believed that as a police officer, politics should not play a role in my life. I did that for the vast majority of my career. But watching what has taken place in our nation, and I attribute much of that to the leader of our nation. And, you know, let's backtrack just one second. Every organization, every entity, whether it's a police department, whether it's a business, whether it's the government, absorbs that leader's ethical and moral sense of responsibility, and it drips down into the organization or in our case, the country. So if the leader of our nation fails to support the police, and in fact, quite the opposite, then not only is the public perception changed, but it also endangers the police because it emboldens the criminal element who sees a weakness and says, hey, you know, let's exploit this. So that's when I really started paying attention. And unfortunately, the last thing I wanted to do was to write that letter. I can tell you that right now. I wish I never had to write that letter. But I believe as a police officer, I believe as a leader, and I believe as an American citizen that I had to do it. And the men and women who serve this country, they needed that voice. They needed that to be told.
Well, I know that he gave a speech last week at the National Police Officers Memorial, and I've seen people asking you, you know, do you think your letter influenced him in any way? What are your thoughts on that?
No, I don't think my letter influenced him at all. In fact, just the opposite. I saw the speech, of course, and I was less than impressed. But more importantly, and it's funny you should mention this, because as we were speaking, I was just, at the moment I called in to your show, I was just finishing my new op-ed piece about this very topic. So at first I didn't think he was even going to show up, because sometimes he does and sometimes he doesn't. You know,
right.
this is the most important policing as far as honor, and sometimes he shows up and sometimes he doesn't. He kind of showed up at the last minute to speak. He devoted an entire 10 whole minutes. 10 whole minutes. Okay.
Well,
here's the important part. In this speech, there was one thing in there that he said that I thought, you know, maybe there's a glimmer of hope here. When he promised that he was going to make sure that the police had what they needed in order to be safe. Well, what happens?
Yeah.
3 days later, today, the Washington Post reveals that under the Obama administration, they are canceling the ability for police departments to get surplus military equipment, some of which is
right.
absolutely essential to fight crime and to keep cops safe. So once again, not only did he not listen to me or hear me or care about it, but he had already planned this and then lied to the American people and the police by saying he was going to support the safety of the police officers. Once again, disappointment.
Well, and I also I want to point out something too about his speech at the memorial service. You know, I looked at the three officers that he mentioned. He had specifically three people that he mentioned that were killed. And I think his real reason for showing up was it normally is. It's all about politics. When I looked at, you know, who the police officers were, One was an African-American male who, while working at a Waffle House to make extra money, was killed while trying to arrest someone. The other one was a white female officer in Texas whose car was swept away in a storm while trying to help others. And the third person was an Hispanic male who had been brought to America from Mexico by his parents, who had always wanted to be a police officer, and he was killed while on a high-speed chase because somebody intentionally crashed into his car to kill him. And so my point is, what's missing here is any mention of any white male officers that were killed. And, you know, with what's going on in Baltimore and Ferguson, you know, again, the president playing to the crowd and not mentioning, you know, any white male officers. And I think, you know, to come there, this is, you know, so much what he does all the time, to come there with a political agenda, in my opinion, and to do that, it speaks volumes about what kind of president he actually is.
Well, I'm not going to disagree that his character is very much on display, but let me point this out to you, that to me, whether the officer was Hispanic or black or female or doesn't, really, what it shows is that they were all blue and that the risks are there no matter what color, no matter what religion. When you put on the uniform, when you decide to take the honor of that badge, your ethnicity goes out the window because, as we say, we all bleed blue. And that unity is what is so important in policing. And while I find it distasteful that he would single people out like that for a political statement, which probably I completely agree with you, what it really demonstrates to me is how we are all bound by that badge and the honor that goes along with it.
And that, Randy, right there, that's what a leader says. That should have been the message rather than what, you know, trying to politicize, taking an opportunity such as that to politicize. And to me, it's just appalling. Now, you had mentioned also in regards to the military equipment, and from what I understand, it's the government is no longer going to pay for that equipment for the police officers, but if they can get it someplace else or, you know, get it themselves or whatever, they could still have it. It's just that the government's not going to pay for it. And you've given your opinion on what you think about that. I want you to look at the other side. There are some people who are saying, you know, that the police officers are getting too militarized, and they were very nervous about the fact that police officers were coming on with, you know, military tanks, military cars, you know, military equipment. Can you speak to that type of thing?
Yes, I sure can. And you know, I understand something very, very important, a very important concept, and that's about the principles of power and the principles of police power. I, too, am afraid of giving any part of the government too much authority and too much power. And I know that there are abuses that take place. I have seen them. And, in fact, I have dedicated the last 15 years to traveling the country and talking to police departments and police associations on the topic of policing with honor, which is based on an article that I wrote published in a number of police magazines, where we discuss in very vivid and real terms ethical survival in law enforcement, surviving your career ethically. And a lot of that is about understanding that power is a corruptible trait. I understand that. I get it. And I don't want to see I find it offensive to see the shall we say, abuse of militarization. For instance, when the protesters first began in Ferguson, the response from the police agencies there was to bring out some heavy equipment and military weapons that they then pointed at the protesters. And you know what? That scared me. So yeah. I understand that there is a legitimate concern on the part of the public that to make sure that their police don't become the army. Now, that's the one argument on the one side. But here's the reality of policing. People who commit crimes, a lot of them have pretty damn good weapons themselves. And the equipment that the military has is designed to protect their personnel, right?
Right.
That is, and that threat level that exists can also exist in civil situations. For instance, barricaded suspects, people with hostages and heavy weapons, or any weapon. When a vehicle pulls up that is armored, and they know that they can't injure or kill the police officers that are inside of it, that intimidating factor to successful conclusion with no one getting hurt, the demonstration of that has brought many successful conclusions to barricaded suspects. Okay? In addition to that, you know, some of the equipment is used, you know, when we're talking about what they are not allowing as of, you know, this new announcement, this includes, you know, riot batons, helmets, things that are really necessary in riot situations. It's expensive equipment. And many police departments simply don't have the budget in order to buy it. So in essence, here's what they're doing. They're taking a necessary safety equipment away from the people who need it the most. And to me, that's unconscionable. So on one, you know, on 3 days ago, he's promising that we're going to give and support the police in every way and make the job safer. 3 days later, the reasoning for it in the Washington Post article was that some members of the community don't like the militarization of the police. So let me see if I understand this. You're going to appease a certain element of people who find it offensive to watch and look at certain pieces of equipment that save the lives of cops, so you're going to take it away from them. It's insane.
Well, and I think what people actually find offensive is not the helmets and the batons and the riot gear. You know, it's more of, you know, having military tanks, you know, and that I can kind of understand. That to me, in my mind, it goes a little bit too far. When you have, you know, you have the SWAT vans and stuff like that, I get that. But to have actual military tanks rolling in, I can see where it would make people nervous. But for,
absolutely.
You know, the helmets,
I agree.
Yeah, but the helmets, batons, it's ridiculous. And you know, the other thing that was really appalling recently, you know, in Baltimore, and I know you saw this, when you have the police officers standing there with their riot gear, these shields, baton, helmets, and they're having, you know, cement blocks thrown at them, and they're not allowed to do anything. They can't be police officers. What do they have to do? They have to run. You know, they're ordered to run, basically, back up and run.
Yeah.
That emboldens the criminal. That's all that did.
I got to tell you, I was watching that. I watched that endlessly, and I've never been so embarrassed watching the surrender of the police. And it's not because the cops didn't want to go do their job. It's because of the inept leadership, the incompetent leadership of their mayor and their police commissioner, who is a political appointee. And then it's followed by what I can only say the grossest miscarriage of justice I've borne witness to in a long time was the news conference that the state's attorney gave when she announced the arrests of all the officers and the unbelievable stacking of charges against them. Their justice system is out of control.
Well, again, you know, I'm maybe a little jaded, but I look at that as it's setting up the police departments to become federalized. It's a way to, you know, you have the perfect scenario. You have this progressive Democrat-run city, you know, Baltimore, that makes all of these really horrendous mistakes, like telling the police to retreat, standing there and berating the police in front of the public and speaking out to, you know, I'm going to say it, the thugs who rioted and looted, and telling them, you know, this is for you, we're doing this for you, you know, it's like, really? And then, you know, all of that together, and then having all of that happen, you know, it's just one travesty right after the other.
Absolutely. It's, you know, watching racial unrest take place is really disquieting to me. And especially when they focus the blame on the cops. What's very interesting is, of course, the Baltimore Police Department is one of the most racially diverse departments in the country, and it has nothing to do with race. Think of this. You know, I kept on hearing some of the people that were getting the most television time were, you know, religious leaders, and I cringe at that title. And they were talking about the racial profiling of the young black man, and that they were hunted by the police, et cetera, et cetera. And I can't help but think, okay, well, let me see if I understand the situation. You have a city of Baltimore, 67% African American. Who is committing the majority of the crime in Baltimore? Young black males between the ages of 17 and 25. Statistically, there is no question about who's doing that. So who are the police? Plus, in some of these neighborhoods, they're 95% African American. Who are the police going to look at? who are the police supposed to target, if you want to use that word, for investigative purposes? It's the people that match descriptions of the criminals who are committing the crime. And who are they trying to protect? They're trying to protect the very citizens who are being victimized by the thugs, the people who lock themselves behind their doors at night, the 98% of the public that are the good, honest citizens that need to be protected from predators.
Right. No, absolutely. And hopefully, you know, it's going to be a telling to see if anything gets better. I for one, with, you know, the president being so negative against police officers, and then having an attorney general that comes in and is basically the same, I don't see how I can get better there. Now, you have a new book out. Let's talk a little bit about The Power of Legacy. What's that about?
Well, The Power of Legacy is my latest book. In fact, I'm very proud to announce that it became a number one bestseller, Amazon number one bestseller last weekend.
Yay! Nice.
And I'm very proud of that. But here's how this book came about, and it's a little different than my last three. My first book, I never intended to be a writer. Let me explain that right off the bat. But I was called to do it, if you will. After a life-changing event, when I was a sergeant, I was on patrol and I saw a car up on the sidewalk and people running around. It was late at night, evening, 9 o'clock or so. I hear this screaming. I have no idea what's going on. I jump out of my car and there's an infant, a 1-month-old, who's been shot in a drive-by shooting. And she was in the back seat, in an infant seat. Mom and dad are driving. They're doing absolutely nothing except going to the store. These gang punks pull up alongside of them and open fire on the car in a gang initiation. And who do they hit? They hit the baby. Well, I was literally there within a minute, and I realized that the baby had stopped breathing. I couldn't wait for an ambulance because she would have died. So I grabbed the first patrol car, and I was able to clear her airway and give her mouth-to-mouth resuscitation on the way to the hospital. And because I was there so quickly, I was able to bring her back, and she suffered no brain damage. And then the doctors did their magic and saved her life.
Wow.
Well, that was such a moving experience for me that I wrote that story. And then I stuck it in a drawer. I had nothing. I just felt like I needed to write it. And then I went about my business for 2 more years. And then the World Trade Center attack happened. And I wanted to do something for the families of the police officers who were killed in 9/11. And so I dusted that story off, and I asked cops all over the nation if they would give me a story about something that moved them. And what happened was the book True Blue, Police Stories by Those Who Have Lived Them, which sold very well, and I donated every single penny of the royalties to the Widows and Orphans Fund for the cops who were killed in 9/11.
Nice.
What that also did was it sparked an interest in writing. St. Martin's Press, who published the book, asked me to write my own book of all my own stories, and that was called A Cop's Life, which is still available. In fact, it's starting to, with all the recent stuff that's been taking place, it's getting a lot of attention. And then I did a third called True Blue to Protect and Serve. So now let's fast forward a little bit. And I briefly mentioned to you what ended my career, and it was a stroke that I had in my police car. And it was the most frightening experience of my life. Literally, I felt my brain slowing down. It was 2:30 in the morning. I was the watch commander. And I had a young patrolman with me, which helped save my life. I felt the stroke coming on. I stopped the police car, and I said to this poor young cop, I said, "You better get me medical attention because I'm having a stroke." And after he got done with the shock, he said, "Oh, my God," he called an ambulance. And I was very fortunate. The little angel that's been sitting on my shoulder for my entire career was hanging out with me again. And I survived it. But when the doctors discovered, what they discovered was that I had a serious medical, uncurable medical condition that was life-limiting. And while that was taking place, I began viewing my life somewhat differently. You know, mortality has never been far away from my thoughts because during my careers, I've been in 5 gunfights. I've saved lives. I've taken lives. I've given life. And at the same time, I've seen life taken on so many occasions. But when you realize that your lifetime may be limited, you began viewing things a little bit differently. And while I lost a lot that night, my mother had died 3 weeks before in my arms. And then my career was taken from me. I had a great deal of loss in a short period of time. But I was also given what I call the gift of clarity, in that I knew that I still had a mission. And the time that I have left, whether it's limited or not, I have a mission. My mission has always been to protect others, but now it changed. And I started thinking about all of the amazing people that I had seen doing acts of kindness and compassion during my career, not just the police officers that I worked with, but members of the community, people that sat up and stood up for others, people that reached out and with a helping hand. And I said, you know what, these are the stories that are important. These are the stories that need to be told. So I took a journey, a year-long journey, traveling the country looking for people that have done amazing things with their lives. And then I interviewed them about who they're personal heroes were. Who was it that inspired them to become the amazing people that they are? And that is what The Power of Legacy, Personal Heroes of America's Most Inspiring People, is all about. I got to meet and interview Frank Shankiewicz, a name that you might not recognize, but you sure as hell know what he did, because he created the Make-A-Wish Foundation when he was an Arizona State Trooper. Mr. Gary Sinise, who, of course, the actor, has done amazing things with veterans. Bill O'Reilly, who's given more than $40 million of his own money to help people. You know, these are the people. And then there's a lot of lesser-known folks. You'll never hear their name, but they've done just tremendous things for others. Those are the people whose stories we need to tell, because America needs heroes now more than any time, and they are among us. And my hope is that when people read this book, they will be inspired to become personal heroes themselves.
I will have to say, I was reading the book this weekend. It is a great book. It has a lot of information in there about people, like you said, people that, you know, they don't talk about themselves, that would never tell you the things that they've done, and they've done some pretty amazing things.
Exactly.
And I really, you have a great way of writing. It really brings people into the book and into what you're trying to say, and they really feel what's going on, and that's, I think, you know, that's another gift that you have, of the many gifts that you do have. But I know there's a chapter on you and your life, and I won't spoil it for those who want to go out and get that book, but it's a really, really good book, and it's called The Power of Legacy, and I hope people do go out and get it. And you, when you were talking about the baby a minute ago, was that Jackie Martinez? Is that the same story,
that's
I believe?
Yes.
Yeah, and what you left out was, tell people what you did about 15 years later in connection with her.
Well, Jackie and her family and I have remained in very close contact, and it was when she turned 15, it was her quinceañera, which in the Hispanic culture is her coming-of-age party, like a bar mitzvah or a confirmation. And her family honored me by inviting me and allowing me to have the dance right after her dad's.
And I can tell that still has a great meaning to you in her life.
Well, that it does. She's 17. She's 17 now. I just had lunch with her, and she asked me to come speak to her class. And she,
nice.
She's become quite an amazing young lady, and I'm very proud that I am in her life.
Well, one of these days, it's probably in a few years, you and her dad will be walking her down the aisle, I have no doubt. So it's such an amazing story, and I did want people to know about that, because I can tell that it's not something that you normally talk about the second half of that story. The first half is amazing, and the second half is just as amazing. I also want to talk a little bit about your another website that you have called CelebratingLegacy.com. Tell us a little bit about what that website is about.
Well, this is something that I have literally been working on since I suffered that stroke and lost my mother. During that period of looking at what my legacy was going to be, I experienced some things that, and I'm sure that many of your listeners will identify with this. When I lost my dad and when I lost my mom, we were very, very close. We were very close friends, as well as being my parents. But it falls to someone, and in this case it was me, to pick up their address book and start making phone calls to the people that they were, you know, close to, and telling them the news that they were dead. And every time you do that, it's like stabbing yourself in the heart. Well, that was one of the things that took place. The other was wondering how their memories would be preserved. I have no family, and so I'm it. I don't want them to be forgotten, and I don't want to be forgotten. So I about the same time, I saw an amazing story. It was Randy Pauch, who was a Carnegie Mellon lecturer. And he came to give what was known as his last lecture, because he was dying of cancer. He wanted to pass on his wisdom to those that he loved, his family and his students. And he just gave this last lecture. And so what came as a result of that was this idea for celebrating legacy, and we're getting very close to launching it right now, or in the testing process. And this is going to be, I believe, one of the most important web services ever created, because it is where memories live forever. This is the ability to leave your legacy in written, audio, or digital form to pass on to future generations, to message into the future, to take away I am now empowered to have a notification letter sent out, or an email sent out to all those people that I loved or that I had a relationship with. And I can leave a personal message to each one of them. So nobody has to pick up that address book and say, Randy's gone. And what this is going to do, we've actually created an entire new social network called the Family Journal, which has even more capabilities than Facebook, because it is all private and it is designed for you to insert your memories in written, audio, or digital form that your great-grandchildren will be able to access and see who you are and what you stood for from you.
Wow. I think it's
we're going to change millions of lives around the world. We're going to touch lives in ways that's never been done before and bring families closer together through the sharing of those memories. And I'm really excited about this. I've literally spent every single penny that I own, and then luckily had some people that believe in me that have come in to help me, both in investment money and also in to create the technology. So we're getting real close. I'm just super excited about that. In fact, anybody that's listening to this broadcast, if they want to go on to celebratinglegacy.com and sign on to become a tester of the site, when we're ready to go into the beta test, they'll get it for free, and they'll be able to keep it forever for free.
Wow. And that's celebratinglegacy.com, and that would be great.
That's it.
People want to go there and do that. Nice. Now, you also have another part of the poweroflegacy.com website, and you have a particular page called Messages to Heaven. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I sure can. You know, this once again arose. I'm one of these guys, and I know that many other people that have lost loved ones feel the same way. Every now and then you feel like you just want to pick up the phone and say something to them, and you can't. But what if they are listening? What if they are watching? I would feel better if I could say something. So I created Messages to Heaven. And it's real simple. Of course, it's free. You know, you go on, my name is Randy, I want to send a message to my mom. And then I put the message in, and I just hit send. And you know what? For those of us that believe that there is something else after this mortal plane, it's a source of comfort. And it's something that I just want to offer people, because I want them to be comforted.
Absolutely, I think it's such a great thing, because you know I lost both parents within 6 months of each other, and I know the feeling of, you know, there are times that you just want to pick up the telephone and, you know, hi mom, how's it going? You know, you can't do that, and this would be a way to allow people to get their emotions out and how they're feeling.
Yes.
And send a message out there, you know, to their loved ones. You know, you've done so much in your life. We have about, you know, 5 minutes left. You know, can you tell me, where do you go from here? You know, have you achieved everything you wanted to? And if not, where do you go from here?
No, I have not. I'm in the process of writing a new Christmas. In fact, it's done. I have a book coming out for Christmas. Called the Christmas Messenger, which is going to be a little gift book that has a very, I believe, an inspiring message that will help readers to communicate with their children about loss and also about about gain when it comes to inspiration, and it's a beautiful little story about Kringle, the Christmas puppy. So that's one of the things. I'm also in editing right now of a new book called Policing with Honor, based on the seminar that I've done around the country. You know, the people that I have so much respect for are those that are still continuing to serve, the men and women of law enforcement. And by being able to reach them with the messages of how to survive your career ethically and not fall prey to the temptations that are always out there, fall prey to the power that you're given, and serve the people that you have sworn to protect with the greatest ideals that encompass policing. That's what this book is going to be about. And I've touched a lot of cops with this philosophical approach, and by creating this book, I'll be able to reach many, many more. And so that's the next process. Then I'm doing a second edition of The Power of Legacy with personal heroes of America's most inspiring leaders. So I've got a lot of stuff on my plate, and you know, at the same time, I'm still continuing to be the voice of American law enforcement under the American Council of Public Safety. I would ask that your listeners go onto my Facebook page, and if they want to communicate, I can be reached on my Facebook. Come to thepowerofLegacy.com and check out defendingtheshield.org, which is the American Council on Public Safety website, defendingtheshield.org. We need your support. There's so many good people that support the police, and you just don't hear about them. They're probably listening to this broadcast right now. We need your support. We need your support spiritually. We need it. We need to know that you care. And I know that the vast majority do.
Well, and you're absolutely right. We do. And, you know, I want to first and foremost thank you so much for your service and all that you've done. I know that you, if called upon, can be instrumental in helping get the police department's image back to where it always was and should have been before recent events. And I'm hoping that they do call on you for that. I can also tell that even though you've been in a police officer for 30 some years, you are not a hardened individual. You certainly are sounding like a very compassionate individual with a soft heart, and I appreciate so much your coming on and all that you do, and look forward to reading your other books. I hope people will go out and buy The Power of Legacy. It is a great book, and Randy, please come back again.
I absolutely will, and thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you, and we'll talk soon. So I do hope you go and get that book. I started reading it this weekend, and it's really an eye-opener and very touching. Randy, sounds like a real humble guy. You know, he didn't tell you a lot about himself. There's so much to know about him, and I think if you are interested, you know, reading his books will certainly allow you to know who he is as an individual and what all he's done. He's done a tremendous amount for all of us, being a police officer for 34 years. And, he's, like he said, he's saved lives, he's taken lives, he's seen a lot, and he's been through a lot. And I hope at least this administration would call on him to be instrumental in helping get the public's view of the police back on the right track. You know, all police officers are not horrible people. All lives matter. All cops matter. They do a great job, and it's a very difficult job, and I think we need to look at that and respect what they do. Are there bad cops? Yes. Are there bad people? Yes. But the majority are good people. So until next week, thank you so much for being here. Have a great week. There's a lot going on in the news. Stay safe. We'll see you next week. God bless you.